that center. So, well, for the government data centers, they reported that they spent in 2007 up to $450 million that year in just power to power up those data centers. Now, even in the more efficient, energy efficient data centers, we see that we can break down the power in the power used by the service itself and the power used by some other components. But the power used by the service itself is usually 80% of all the power that the data center uses. If we take one of those single servers and break down the power consumption of all its components, we can break down the power in this way, where CPU uses most of the power with 33%, and RAM and disk, which is the components that we're going to talk more about in this presentation. They consume 30 and 10% respectively for a total of 40% just for the servers. Now, if you take that 40% and convert to the 80% in the complete data center, we have that disk and memory alone consume 32% of all the energy of data center, right? So 32% that the data center consume just goes to memory and disk. Now, that 32% compared to the 450 million is, for example, 144 million just to power up disks and memory. Now, this is not going to get any better. Well, RAM continues to increase, and storage also continues to increase. So this is just going to get worse as time passes. And moreover, the price of the energy is worse and worse each time. It just increased in the last decade. So it seems like it's not going to get any better. Now, as I said in this presentation, we're going to focus on the disk and memory components, mostly on disks. Now, well, what are the benefits of saving that power? First, well, as I said, we can reduce the data center operation cost up to 32%. But also in mobile devices that the laptop we're using, it can have a longer lasting battery life. So we could better utilize the energy and keep our devices on for longer period of time with the same charge. Now, the challenge of saving that power is that usually saving the power comes at a performance cost. There is a trade-off of performance for the energy that you're saving. I have, for example, some examples here. First, I have the CPU. It turns out that the CPU has several power levels, and as lower is the power, worse is the performance of the CPU. Right? So it's usually when you lower the power level, you certainly save the power, but you also consume, you also are able to execute instructions more or slower. Memory is another example. The problem with memory is that it refreshes because it is not persistent. It needs to refresh itself frequently, and these constantly consume power. Right? This is called the idle power. And the only way to save this power is by decreasing the size of the memory, so it has to refresh less banks or less of the RAM. And we can do that, for instance, by exchanging some of the RAM, part of the RAM with a flash, which consumes less power than the RAM itself. But doing something like that, we increase the paging activity, and also we degrade the performance of the applications.
So just a quick clarification, sorry. The CPU, you say that with lower power levels, you get lower performance. But if you look at, let's say, a set of instructions that you have to execute,
yeah,
the energy is different from power. The total energy that you spend for executing those set of instructions, regardless of the power level, is that the same or is it different?
I think the power the performance and the power used with the performance increase not linearly, increase in fact.
Not power. Now we are talking about energy.
Oh, okay.
So how much energy are you spending? I mean, what's the cost of running this for the same set of instructions?
Yeah, I think if you want to run those instructions faster, you will consume more energy at the end.
Total.
Yes, total energy. Yes, and that's. I heard once that that's the reason why now we have multi-cores, because having two cores of 1 gigahertz each is more energy efficient than have one core with 2 gigahertz, for instance. So, because the increase in energy is not linear with the performance that you get. It's more, I think it's more exponential. Make sense? Okay. Okay, so to continue with examples, we have now disks, which is one of the primary focus on the dissertation. And one of the things I want to emphasize that disks are not energy proportional. Now, what energy proportional means is that if you have a perfect proportional device, then you will use exactly, you will use more energy as more load you have in that device, right? And less energy as less load you have in that device. That's the idea of having proportionality in energy. Now, in the specific case of this, you have two states of power, two power consumption levels. Basically, you can only, well, the two states are spun down, which the disk is not rotating, and then you have spinning, where the disk is in its normal state, where it can operate, and this is constantly rotating. Right? So, those are the two power levels, and the one characteristic of the disk is that you can only save power while the disk is not rotating, so it's spun down, right? Now, the problem, well, if you can save power, why not keep the disk spun down all the time? Well, the thing is that if you, you cannot access the data, and if you want to access the data while the disk is spun down, then you have to incur a delay of seconds. Sometimes it's 2 seconds, sometimes it's even as bad as 10 seconds. In order to wait till the disk start rotating again and is able to do the access. Now, the problem is that when the disk is rotating, the amount of power that it consumes is constant, independently of the amount of load that it has. If you are using 100% of the disk, or using 10% of this, you have more or less the same amount of power used by the device. So we're going to see some solutions to how to save power in disk and RAM. So first in disk, well, as I said, you can spin down the disk when not in use and you can save power. But as I said, this can incur in delays when the disk is accessed while spinning down. And usually applications do not provide long idle times for the disk to go to sleep and save some power. Okay. Now, you can also use an
question.
Oh, sorry.
So are you saying that on a disk it won't make any difference if you are doing a lot of seek versus if the disk is just rotating and not serving any idle, the power consumption is equal?
It's not exactly the same. Certainly, the seeks will make a difference. But what I'm saying is that it will remain mostly unchanged, right? There is no significant change between not doing seeks and doing seeks, right?
Yeah. Some
numbers? Sure. I think if I can remember correctly, there was something on the order of 5 additional watts when you have random access, or 10 out of I think was 30 or 40 watts. So yeah, so 20% more, right?
And how does that contrast with spun down power?
Well, in the spawn down case, you almost consume no power at all. So it's out of 30, for instance, you consume, I think it's 1 or even less, which is just keeping the controller on in case you need you need to spin up the disk again. Right?
With the type of operations and read or write make a difference?
Excuse me, say that again.
Would the read or write leaks make a difference?
I think writes probably spend a little bit more power because it needs to work a little bit more. But I think it won't make a big difference. Yeah. Probably what it makes a difference, though, is having random or sequential accesses, because in random you have to move ahead a lot. In sequential, you don't, right? So you're just basically spending the power of the disk, of just rotating the disk.
So Lewis, I mean, when you say maybe and probably and you think,
yes.
You actually measure these things, right? And you can
yeah.
actually be confident about
yes.
all this information.
True, yeah.
So it's better to,
okay.
to state it that way and also state what is the source of the information.
Yeah, okay. Well, the thing is that I measured that a long time ago, so I don't remember the exact numbers, but I did the measures myself, so, and...
How about dosage speed? Does this for multiple
dosage speed? Yeah, in the case of the rotation, I know that the consumption, the power consumption of the rotation depends, of course, it makes a difference the speed of rotation, but the power consumption also increased not linear, it increased more exponentially. Same idea than the CPU. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So Avi, does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay. So I guess we can move forward. Okay. So another solution to save power in disk is now to be aggressive on the caching by doing, buffering more writes and also prefetching more data. So the disk can be idle for a longer period of time, right? Now the problem with this is that memory may not be big enough to hold all the working set of the application, so there will always be misses, even though you did very good on prefetching and also on buffering. And the other problem is that you cannot buffer for a long period of time because the memory is not persistent, so you may have data loss. Another solution is to use an additional device, flash for instance, which consumes less power than disk, as external caching. So now, apart from RAM, you also have this device to cache and prefetch and also buffer data. And moreover, this device is persistent, so you can buffer for a longer period of time as well. And then this, of course, will help to keep the disk idle for a longer period of time than the two other solutions, and then save even more power. Now, if you have a RAID system, for instance, a system with many disks, then usually these many disks are provisioned to be able to serve a peak load, right? Now, usually the case is that you don't need the peak bandwidth of the device, but you only need a small portion. So one idea is to duplicate some of the data in the RAID in a fewer number of disks and then turn off the rest of the disks that you currently don't need because the load is low now. So in case of the memory, two solutions is to increase the locality so you only focus on a small portion of the RAM, and that allows you to save some power. And also use multi-power RAM, which is more or less the idea of the CPU. As you need less of the RAM bandwidth, you lower each performance, but you get better energy efficiency. So it turns out that for all these solutions, there is a publication. The one that we are concerned in this presentation is for this is 3 and 4, and 1 and 2. So in 3 and 4, the problem with external caching so far is that they all have been simulation, right? And they don't present some challenges that you could have in a real implementation. And in the case of multi-disk systems, they are either not proportional, like this case, or because they do not provide many levels of power based on the load. And there are all solutions also that they have to copy too much data. And in the case of memory, even though they are able to save power in memory, in other areas, the idle power is still the same. They keep the RAM the same size, and now the RAM needs to refresh itself every time. So it will keep consuming that power, right? Now, in this dissertation, we aim to reduce the energy consumption of computer systems, in this case, disk and memory. The idea is to first design a multi-disk energy proportional system using just commodity devices, no new hardware required. We call this solution SRC map. We'll see details later. Also, design and implement an energy efficient storage system using flash, a flash device as external cache, and then keep the disk idle for longer period of time and save power. We call this system Excess. And then we also design and implement a new mechanism to eliminate blocking read page operations due to page write to pages that are not in memory. So it turns out that this has the property to keep undisturbed disks for longer period of times again and keep them spawned down to save power. And also, this can help the performance of applications as we'll see later. The solution for this is called non-blocking writes. And for all these, we will present details later. So here I have a small diagram of the contribution of the dissertation. First, we have the areas we're able to improve. First, we have the energy in multi-disk systems. We have also the energy in single-disk systems. And also, we have performance, right? Now, each of these systems, as I said, they improve either SRC map, for instance, improve multi-disk system access. We're able to improve single the energy efficiency of single disk systems, and then in non-blocking writes, we're able to improve the performance of applications. Now, in terms of the dashed lines, even though we don't show the actual improvement, we show how we can help improve, for instance, non-blocking writes can improve SRC math, and non-blocking writes can improve the effectiveness of access as well. And we also show how the improvement in performance can help to improve the energy efficiency of RAM. So now let's start with how we increase the energy efficiency of multi-disk systems with SRC map. And the way SRC map improves the energy efficiency is by making disks more energy proportional. I mentioned earlier that disks are not energy proportional. They usually have two power levels. And the problem is that in data centers, usually their storage is provisioned for peak loads. So in this case, we have 8 disks. The problem is that even though we have so much disk bandwidth, now we only need, let's say, 10 to 30% of all the bandwidth available, right? And that's usually the average case. So usually the average case is that you need just a small portion of the bandwidth and not the whole big load. Now the problem here is that even though we use only a small portion of the bandwidth, we end up using all the power of all the disks, independently of the amount of load that that the disk has, right? So basically the energy use is unproportional. Now, it's well known that consolidation is a technique to save power by consolidating virtual machines in few servers, right? And then we can make that energy proportional by powering up more servers if required. Now, the question is, can we use a storage virtualization layer to design a practical energy proportional system? And then we can take advantage of the storage virtualization and indirect all the IOs in a fewer disks and after consolidating the data. The problem here is that the challenge is that moving logical volumes, you can think of logical volumes as a partition or a virtual disk, which contain a file system. The problem is that moving these logical volumes, which typically are in the order of several gigabytes, from one device to another can be prohibitively expensive because this amount of data can take long time to move and can also interfere with foreground IOs.
the assumption is that the whole star system is not fully utilized.
Yes.
So the numbers 10 to 30%, where did that go?
Yes, there is a work from, can't remember the name, but it's from some guys at Google, that they talk about data centers and how the power is consumed, and they say that typically the power consumption the load of the storage is in the order of 10 to 30%, even I think of the whole server is 10 to 30% of the actual bandwidth provision.
Is it the load on local servers or load on the distributed servers? So imagine, say, like in a cloud, you have lots of virtual machines hitting the shares.
Yes.
Storage backend. I would imagine the average would be much higher.
Yes. It's actually not the local, but it's more the distributed. And I guess the problem is that. The problem is that they need to provision it for the peak because they need to give some guarantees of how much time it will take to complete a request. So and they have to be ready in case there is a peak in the load, right? So that's why they need to provision for the peak load. But the truth is that usually it's not fully utilized, the language, right?
Suggestion is that you have data from production systems that you've analyzed. You can refer
yes.
to that for centralized
yes.
storage.
True.
And also, there's a bunch of work from Microsoft Research, the Everest work, for instance,
yes.
that they've made similar observations.
Sure, yes.
So that's true. More pertinent to what you're talking here.
Yeah, that's true. I guess what they're talking about, in this particular work, we analyzed some traces from FIU servers itself. And we found similar numbers, 10 to 30% load as well. Right? That's what you
right,
mean.
And there is this Microsoft Research work.
Of Everest, yeah. Okay. But they offload and they
right
have
off.
Similar results.
Yeah.
Yes, and they have similar results. Okay. Yeah, so does that answer our question? Okay. So here I have an overview of SRC map. So let's start by describing more or less the architecture of a storage utilization manager. First, the storage utilization manager exports some logical volumes to servers, I guess. And then there can be I requests with the pair volume LVA, or logical block address of the logical volume itself, right? So after you receive a request with this pair, the storage virtualization manager can remap that IO to the actual location of the data in any of the physical volumes that it has. Right? So what SRC map, having this architecture, SRC map, what it does is that it first starts by reserving some space that is called the scratch space. Now, after it saves this space, it detects the working set of each of the physical volumes. The working set, in this case, is defined as all the blocks that were absent some period of time. This period of time is typically days, right? It can be 10 days, for instance. After you have this working set, we can make replicas of these working sets in the scratch space. Note that these working sets usually are much smaller than the total size of the data that is residing in the physical volume. And we have the luxury to make various replicas of that working set because the space is not as big. Now, after we create the replicas, for instance, in the physical volume A, we create replicas of C and E, of the working set of C and E, and in B, we create of D, and so on. Now, SRC map will detect that it can, in the next 2 hours, for instance, it can serve all the IOs, or it is able to serve all the load the IO is having, by just powering up two disks, right? So what it does is to power off the remaining disks that are not required, And then we can redirect IOs to these two disks that are on. And for instance, if we need something from the working set C, we redirect to A. Right? Now, there are a couple of details here. For instance, if we need some data that is in the physical volume C, but was not part of the working set, then we need to redirect that data to C again, and we need to spin up the disk. We need to incur the several seconds delay I mentioned, and then we can finally get the data. Now, the good news is that now that we have the data, we make that part of the working set of C, and then hopefully we won't miss on that log anymore. Another detail is that since we're predicting not only reads but writes, now we can have data of the working set C, which is more up to date in the scratch space of A, for instance. And that means that at some point we need to update the other copies of that data in order to keep that data up to date. And we call that the synchronization errors. Hopefully I'm not forgetting something. It turns out that SRC map is able to achieve one energy or almost one energy level per disk. And given that we're only working with working sets, it has low space overhead. And also, as we saw, it's able to adapt to working shift by augmenting the current working sets with whatever is accessed currently, right? Either writes or reads. Now, we implemented and evaluated a prototype of SRC map with real workload traces. As I said, workloads from FIU servers, mail server, there was a web server, and also the online course management system. And in them, we found savings, power savings of 35 to 59%.
So, Luis, I'm not sure I understand one energy level per day.
Sure. So the idea is that we're able, as the load increase, we were able to spin up just the number of disks that we need to serve that load, right?
So I understand that, but I'm not sure I understand the language there. Okay, that's fine. So you're just saying energy proportionality.
Yes. Yeah, I'm not sure what
Yeah, well, I don't understand the phrase one energy level per day.
Oh, I
see. I don't
see
how that is energy proportionality, but if that's what you mean, okay.
Sure, the thing is that we can only achieve one energy level per disk, because given that disks only have two power levels,
right.
So you can only have as many levels as disks you have, right? Okay. Now, it turns out that I talked about how the writes, the IOs can have a miss, and they have to spin up some disks to have the data retrieved. But it turns out that those are usually very small. And in our experiments, we found that those to be only 0.003% of all the requests. Okay. Now, it turns out that the synchronization IOs to update the data in all the copies was affecting the performance, and we in the future we need some new scaling mechanism to lower the performance impact that these synchronization IOs have. Now the impact of having of SRC map is that first we just setting a few parameters like the consolidation interval, which we said that is two hours, and also the history size that we're going to use for the working set. But just setting a few parameters, the administrators, for instance, are able to save power with low work from their part. Now, we test this with only 8 disks, but usually in data centers, this scale is much bigger than 8 disks, right? Usually they need much more disk, and given that it's one energy level per disk, it's more likely just to get better as the number of disks increase. Now, I said that, again, we can achieve one energy level per disk, and the problem is that if you have a single disk system, then you cannot save power here, because you cannot replicate the data in our disk and power on disk. So you cannot really use this assumption for a single disk system. So for that, we have Excess, which is able to save power even when you have a single disk system. Right? So the goal of Excess is that we want to increase the inactivity of the disk by caching, prefetching, and write buffering the data in this external device, which will be a flash, that consumes less power than the disk itself. Now, we need to make the effective use of this external flash caching by adapting to workload changes, so we're able to heat more in the future, or have more heats in the future. And finally, we need to ensure block level consistency in all system states to keep the data safe. So I have here a small diagram of how Excess would work. There are four components: the operating system, the application, disk, and the flash, where we are doing the caching. The idea is that we redirect all, or the operating system will redirect data as much IOs as it can from the application to the flash. And if there is a miss, then we just need to go to follow the normal path, and then spin up the disk and get the data we need. And finally, to adapt to the workload changes, we need some periodic reconfiguration that readapts whatever data is in the flash in order to be more representative of the working set we have until now. Now, just to have an example of what Excess would do, we have this is just the disk accesses, the accesses that the disk would see in time. So for instance, in Manila, it's not optimized. So it will have many IOs, and not only that, but it will be scattered all over time. Now, if we have aggressive caching, we prefetch and buffer a lot of data, then the disk will see less. First, it will see less IOs, right? Because we're caching and buffering aggressively. But moreover, we will see some clustering of the IO itself, which also will also allow for longer period of IO times. Now, the problem here is that given that the RAM may not be big enough for the working set, we can still have misses, and then we will need to spin up the disk and then at the end we won't save as much power as we can. Now, when we add this external device in Excess, we are able not only to cluster more IOs. Well, the thing with Excess is that we can hold bigger working sets. So we're able not only to cluster these IOs, but also keep longer idle period of times, and also the disk will see less IOs because we're catching much more data. We're able to serve much more data from this device and also buffer more data. Now, it turns out that Excess was the first implementation of this kind of system. We designed and implemented Excess for Linux. So we were able to evaluate Excess in a laptop using USB and Compact Flash as external device. And also, we use a desktop developer and server workload, which were basically the works of benchmark called BLTK from Intel, especially designed to evaluate the power efficiency of laptops. And also, we use a server workload, which was Postman, a mail-like server, a mail server-like workload. Now, we found with Excess that there was a savings from 2% to 14%. Of power and across all these workloads, and we found that with external caching, we could have a substantial impact in performance. In particular, we have run-intensive workloads that were affected by performance because the flash is usually not very good in writes, and then the performance at the end was very bad, up to 14x. Now, the impact of excess is that we would have a better energy efficiency in mobile devices by simply plugging an external device like a USB key, which is widely available and also very cheap. Okay, so far we have talked about SRC map and XS, which are both cache systems to save power in disk. Now, their effectiveness will depend on the number of cache hits that you have in this cache. In the case of SRC map, in the fewer disks that you have on, in the case of XS, in the flash that you're using. And some other thing I want to know is that so far all the caching is performed at the page granularity, right? Okay, so now let's recap how this kind of caching system will handle misses. First, if there is a read to a page that is not cached, then we require the attention of the primary disk with the data. Right? So there is no way around it. If we have a full page write, we can buffer the data in the cache, and we don't need the attention of the primary disk. But if we have a sub-page write, which is just a small portion of a page, then we still need to read the data from the disk, the primary disk. So we need that attention, and we need to spin on that disk to do the merge. That's now we read that data, and we write just a small portion that we were planning to write. And then we can move forward. But that means that if we require this kind of write, then we still need to spin up the disk, right? Now that dependency, we will break that dependency with non-blocking writes, as we will see. And it turns out that breaking that dependency will make SRC map and XS more effective by not missing as much as before. Moreover, we see how non-blocking write is able to improve performance, and we also see how non-blocking write that performance improvement is able to or has the potential to improve the energy efficiency in RAM. Okay, so in the case of non-blocking writes, we initially focus on the operating system caches, mainly file system cache and the virtual memory. And in these two cases, what we observe is that the memory access granularity is usually smaller than the disk access granularity. So doing a small write to a page that is not in memory usually requires a full page fetch. So to understand this better, I have this small example of how this would work on a normal system, operating system. So we have three components: the process, the backend store where the page is, and finally the operating system. And the idea is that the process tries to do a write, and because the page is not in memory, it fails. This means then the control is passed to the operating system, saying, okay, we had a miss on this page. Then the operating system, what it does, say, okay, if you don't have a page, then you issue the I/O, and then the I/O completes, right? Now at this point, the page will be in memory, so it's fine if we need to write. That's why the operating system return control to the process, and the process try to write again, right? Now, in this case, it was successful. Now, in this whole process, the question is, why do we have to read and wait for a data that we don't actually need, or the process actually doesn't need, right? So in this case, what is happening is that this process has to wait for these two things to happen, even though it actually doesn't need the data, right? We found that this behavior is common in commodity operating systems like Linux, BSD, and Xen. And the way we approach this problem is by, well, we'll see how that will go with a small sample. Again, we have the processor that is right to a page and external memory, and we have the miss again. Now, instead of using the fetch right away, one thing we can do is that we create, we buffer the data temporarily. And we call that data now a patch that we will apply later. And then we can issue the page fetch, right? And finally, since we buffer data, the data is safe in memory now, we can return control to the process, right? So note here that these steps, the process didn't have to wait for the IO. Now the process is able to move forward much faster than before because it doesn't have to wait for potentially several microseconds, for instance, before it can move forward, right? Now with just a few, just in a small amount of time, just probably a fault, and then creating the batch and so on, it can move forward, which is, of course, much faster than having the IO set.
Louis, when you say microseconds, is it always the case that the IOs will take microseconds?
Well, I guess that's the best case for IO. Usually, IO also goes in the range of milliseconds instead of microseconds. Microseconds is for the new devices like SSD, but I guess it's more typical milliseconds. Yeah. Okay, once the process has the control, the IO at some point will finish, right, will complete, and then we can apply the patches. So one thing I forgot to mention here, which is interesting, is that once we return control to the process, note that the process can write the same page, several times, even though the page is not in memory, right? And that's why we have here a queue of patches. So every time the process follows this path, we will have a new patch here, and then that queue of patches is the one we are going to apply after the IO is completed, right? One by one in the order they were created. Now, doing this kind of operation has two benefits. We will have a reduced access latency to pages that are not in memory. I guess it's updates to pages that are not in memory. And also, we will have increased backing and store bandwidth usage, even on single-thread applications that before can have only a single app. So I will explain these two in more detail next. So let's start with how non-blocking write achieves page fetch asynchrony. So for that, we have this small sample, which we'll start with what would happen in the normal system. Okay, so let's say that in the normal system, the application tried to do a write to a page P. Let's say that P is not in memory, so the operating system will issue the fetch, and the application has to wait for that IO to finish. And then finally, the write to P can go through, right? We have
the two writes, or just the same write?
No, this is the same write, sorry. This line here means that it tried to do the write, but it couldn't because the page was not in memory. And this is the actual write, okay? So there are two attempts here. That's what each arrow means. Then we have some thinking time, some processing time of whatever data or you have. And then let's say that you try to read P, but because P was just read, it's most likely in memory. So it's most likely to go through also. And then we have some other thinking done, let's say. Now let's see what would happen in non-blocking writes. In non-blocking writes, first we try to write P, but because in non-blocking writes we don't have to wait for the IO to finish, the write to P go through, and the operating system saying that it was fine, right? So after that, we can go ahead and do the thinking time we have here, because the application thinks that the write was fine. Well, I guess it was fine, but it's buffer. So after that, we have the read P, but as you see here, it's batch, so it means that it tried to read the P, but it couldn't. So now we can actually have to wait for the rest of the IOs to finish, right? After that IO is finished, we can actually do the read. And finally, we have that small portion of thinking time here, right? Now, the takeaway from here is that, well, first, when numlock and write, we're able to immediately return from the write, even though the page is not in memory. And second, the reason why we're able to save some time in these operations with numlock and write is that because we're able to overlap this computation time with some of the IO, right? So in this case, half of the IO time. Now, let's see how numlock and write help on parallelism. Again, we start with an example of what would happen currently. Again, we try to write B, was not in memory, we wait for an IO. But now we try to do the same thing with a page called Q. And finally, we do a read on B, right? So what you see in this case is that, assuming that the application is single thread, the application have to sequentially wait for each of those IOs. Okay. Now, in the case of non-blocking writes, what would happen when the application tries to write P is that it will successfully write P, so it can move forward in the operation, and it will try to write Q, right? And we also be successful right away. So what would happen is that the read will come next, like the one we have there. And now the read, because we cannot delay the waiting anymore, we need the data that the page fetch actually tried to bring to memory. The read feed would have to wait for the IO, and then we can finally read the page B when data is in memory, finally memory. So what we can see here is that we have an increase in IO parallelism. We can have both IOs at the same time in process, and this can only happen with non-blocking writes. See that in the case of blocking writes, we have to do them in sequence. Now this can take, of course, very advantage of the devices with parallelism like SSD or even RAID systems, and also. We increase the efficiency of IO schedulers because now the scheduler can have more IOs to work with. So it has more potential to optimize the accesses. Now, I said that non-blocking write is able also to help in the effectiveness of SRC map and excess, right? So to understand how non-blocking write will help excess or SRC map, I have here a small, I will make a small, a slightly change in how we will see, in how we saw non-blocking write before. So again, the process tries to write to a page that is not in memory and the operating system catch the miss. We create a patch. Okay? Now, instead of issuing the fetch right away, given that the application doesn't need the data, we can actually return the control to the process and move forward. Right? Now, at some point, we need to fetch the data. So for that, we have an oracle that will tell us when to actually fetch the data. After it triggers a fetch, we issue the fetch, the IO is complete again, and we apply all the patches that we created for that page. Now, the oracle can be the policy that we have for that oracle can be different depending on the goal of the system, right? So here I have a list of how we can change the oracle in order to have different goals. So for instance, to save power, the oracle can delay the fetches until the disk is spinned up. So for instance, if we see that the disk is spun down, the oracle say, okay, this disk is saving power, so we better don't bother about this. That's a case that of course can help access and SRC map. But also it can help system under resource pressure. like pressure in disk or pressure in memory. If pressure of disk, let's say that currently the disk has a high load, then the Oracle can decide not to fetch that page right away. And if it's under memory pressure, it can also delay the fetch, because then we will need to allocate, it's probably not the best time to allocate a fresh frame to do the IO. And finally, even if we're not on the memory pressure, we can still reduce the memory usage by delaying the page allocation that we need for the IO itself. So this particular can help systems where we require to use a small amount of memory to be able to save some power by getting rid of some of the RAM, right? And save some of the idle power that RAM requires. Okay, so now that we have talked about the patches, there are a bunch of optimizations that we can do with the patches. For instance, one of the most interesting ones is that we can read the data from patches, so we can delay even further the IO if we require. And that means that we are actually making the reads to out-of-core pages also asynchronous, right, in that case. But I guess we only have this chance with non-blocking bytes. We can also merge the patches together. If we create patches for two data that they are together in the page, then we can merge them together and save some memory in metadata. And finally, if we overwrite a patch, then we can reuse the patch that is currently there, and we can reduce the memory we're using for patches, and also reduce the patch queue size that helps in reducing the time we need to apply the patches after it is completed. I implement all of them, and they actually very useful, surprisingly useful, actually. Okay, so let's see the evaluation of non-blocking writes. Well, we implemented non-blocking writes for Linux and x86. I implemented all the patches optimizations. And for now, we only evaluated the asynchronous mode for performance. Asynchronous mode is the mode that we saw, the first mode that we saw of non-blocking write, where we issue the fetch right away. And to do the evaluation, we used 10 workloads, 4 spec CPU, which are single-threaded, 4 da capo benchmark, which are multi-threaded, spec SFS, which is a server-like workload, and finally spec power, which is basically an application server. In this presentation, I will focus on the spec CPU single-threaded and the spec SFS file server work. The rest is in the dissertation. So, so let's see what happened with the single thread application. So in this graph, in the x-axis is the workload, and in the y-axis is the improvement in time, right? So what that means is that if we non-block in write, we use less time than in vanilla, then we see a positive line here because it's an improvement, right? This is all a percentage compared to the vanilla time, the time of the base configuration, I guess. And in all these cases, I run the experiments 5 times, and so we're getting here the average, and also the difference in average and the coefficient of variation was less than 2%, meaning that they were very stable. Now we see here, I separated the improvements in how much time we have to wait, how much CPU additional CPU uses, and the total improvement, right? So let's start with the IO. So the first two, they really didn't have much improvement or change in non-blocking write, so I won't talk about this. I will talk about these two, which show more clearly how non-blocking write influence in the execution of the applications. So in this case, what we see is that non-blocking write, of course, is able to reduce the amount of IO, of waiting time that the application has to do on IO. Okay? So in this particular case, non-blocking write was able to save 3% and 3.5% of the time that it has to wait for IO. And then, if we see the CPU, we see that there is degradation in the amount of CPU that it has to use. It turns out that non-blocking drive has to use more CPU, and that makes sense because now, first, the applications don't always block while waiting for an IO to finish. And also, for every write, we need more CPU to create patches and do the whole process which order. Now, in the third bar, we can see the actual improvements. So non-blocking write, if you add these two up, you have the actual savings. So it turns out that non-blocking write for these particular benchmarks and also for these memory types, we found that it has a 2.1% increase in performance, or that would be 2.1% reduction in execution time, total execution time. Now we also found that this improvement is higher when the memory size is reduced. We will see that next. And the other thing is that the memory overhead usually was very small. So the amount of, even though we had to create a lot of patches, it turns out that the memory, even in the worst case, used by the patches was less than 0.1% of the total memory we provisioned. So let's see what happened when you decrease the memory size in with non-blocking drives. So what I did here is that I took a single benchmark. In this case, it was the LAN benchmark, which is this last one, right? And then I start to decrease the memory size. Now, each point is 5 runs, and the coefficient of variation increases because now you depend more on the disk. And what happens is that, the thing is that, introduce the graph. The x-axis is the memory size we have, and the y-axis is the execution time. So, the blue line is vanilla, and the green line is non-blocking bytes. It's the execution of non-blocking bytes. So, what we see is that as we start decreasing the memory size, the gap between the line of non-blocking write and vanilla starts to increase, meaning that as we decrease the memory size, non-blocking write is able to improve the execution time more and more. Right? Now, the reason non-blocking write is able to improve is because as the memory size is smaller, the application tend to have more misses because less memory is available, and these give a higher chance to non-blocking write to optimize. Right? Now, as we see, the improvement increase with lower memory, and in this case, in 260, there is up to 7% improvement. Up to 7% improvement. So I believe that if you keep going, you will have more and more improvements. And now that non-blocking write is able to help with when you have small amount of memory, that is a good, then non-blocking write is a good candidate to reduce the memory, as I said earlier, and save some idle power of the RAM. So I guess this slide proves that the how non-blocking write would help with that.
Why didn't you go further?
I'm actually still going further. I'm still running experiments right now. The thing is that, as you see, the execution time, it goes to 2,500 seconds, and every point I have to run 2,500 seconds 5 times. So it takes a long time to do the experiments. But it definitely will continue further and see what happens.
Right. But in modern systems, you're heading this way, so really your gains are becoming lower and lower.
Right? True, but also applications are consuming more and more memory.
So the gains are steadily only going down. So the value of these non-blocking drives are getting lower.
I see. I guess that's true for memory, but when You can also think of this in the file system. I guess the file system, the working set will be much bigger as well. So probably in file system, this will also be more effective, right? Remember that this is just for virtual memory, this experiment. I should probably try the file system and we'll see better outcomes.
Hold on. I mean, do you want to rethink that answer that memory sizes are only going to improve and working sets are going to remain the same?
Oh, I see. I don't know if we're just thinking, but I guess one of the points of the experiment is to show that is that when we reduce the memory, the thing is that you need to reduce the memory in order to save power, because the memory will be the next power consuming of the machine. We will see that in the future work. But the thing is that we need to decrease the memory if we want to make systems more power efficient. And then this will help, right? So I don't know if that's what you're trying to say.
No, I'm not saying that. I'm not talking about energy at all. I mean, can we run our current workloads with 16 megabytes of memory that we had in machines 10 years ago or 20 years ago? Can we run our workloads of today?
No, we can't.
Why is that?
Because currently applications are using much more memory.
Why?
The working set size is getting bigger.
Why?
Because we are able to process more data? Or
no, because there is more memory. So the point being that as we get systems with more and more memory, people will run applications with larger and larger memory requirements.
I see.
Right?
Some
boomers
love to actually consume more memory.
Yeah.
Because they take more time to write some data control.
Sorry, I couldn't hear. Can you repeat that?
I was saying software engineers love to use more memory because it takes more time to write code, which is memory efficient. Mm-hmm. The more you can consume, the better it is in terms of productivity.
Oh, I see. Okay.
All of this is still strengthening my argument, saying that you're going to get lazier and write code that uses more memory, which means that you'll
have less.
No, you won't head that way. What head this way? What is going that way is the amount of physical memory you have. That's the actual physical memory size.
Right.
So that's the machine you bought.
Yeah.
And then you have an application that has a certain amount of memory requirement. In this experiment, it's not changing at all.
Right. No, I understand that. But your application can fit anywhere in the spectrum, right?
This is only one application. This is not a generic experiment that would work for every application. It's just one of those applications.
So what you're saying is that the memory will be fixed. I mean, the only way to increase the memory is to buy more hardware, which is always a problem, right?
That's not the point, though. I mean, the point is that, yes, you will have cheaper memory in the future, but the applications will also change to use that memory. Right? Which is why we cannot run our applications of today with the hardware of, 10 years ago.
I see, but I guess the point of Professor Gee is that you will also increase the memory. I mean, is the use of the or the additional memory that the application is using will surpass the increasing in the memory size?
But that's not how the industry works, right? I mean, if there is no requirement, people would not invest money into building memories that are bigger and cheaper, right? If no one is using all that memory, why spend all that time and money to generate such hardware, which is not going to be used?
Okay.
So the reason people are developing bigger memory systems is that there is a need in the future.
Okay.
And the applications of the future will use that memory.
Okay, so I guess the applications will always react to more memory. I mean, if you have more memory, then I will use more memory, always.
Isn't that the trend we see?
Okay. Okay. These are all with single thread applications so far. Now, it turns out that when we run non-blocking writes with multi-thread applications, we saw a degradation of up to 8%, right? in the execution time. So, well, I guess the question is why. So, for that, we have a small sample. So they say that the initial state that we have two ready-to-run processes. Again, this is for multi-thread applications, right? This doesn't happen in single-thread applications. So we have two ready-to-run processes, P1 and P2, and we have one CPU to run those, right? Now, well, I guess you can think of these as a threads. Now, the red process is a process that is constantly writing to pages that are not in memory. Well, P2 is a process that will or have all the data it needs in memory, so it's able to progress much faster. Right? So let's see what happened in vanilla. In the vanilla case, what would happen is that P1, since P1 again is writing constantly to pages that are not in memory, so what happens is that once it takes the CPU, it will issue a miss. And then while the IO is completed, the operating system will put in the waiting queue. And then it will run P2, right? So that's what would happen in vanilla. Let's see what happened in non-blocking writes. In the non-blocking write case, what would happen is that P1 will stay in the CPU. And the reason is that since it is using non-blocking write, it issued a fetch. But it can stay in the CPU all at once because it will start creating patches and patches and patches. Now, the problem here is that each write in P1 is much less efficient than a write to actual memory, right? Now, the point here is that if we do something more like this, where we leave the process that is actually making faster progress because it doesn't need intervention of the operating system like P1 does, then we will be able to progress much faster or use the CPU better with P2 than P1. Hopefully that was clear. Okay.
So how do you address this?
Yes, sure. So
this is what I described.
Yes.
I can comment during the proposal.
Yes, yes. So we have two possible solutions, so let's talk about them. Now, the first solution is to have multiple processes, processors. Now, if we have multiple processors, then we can run each of them in two different processes, and each one won't take the CPU. So they actually will have their CPU, and even though this is not progressing fast enough, it's not interfering in the progress of P2. So the performance should be as good, right? Actually, it should be better because P1 is able to progress without waiting for the IO. Now the thing is that this is like cheating because at some point you will have so many threads that you can take both CPUs, creating passes, like in this case, and then you would have exactly the same situation. So for that, we have a second solution, I guess also more general. And the idea here is that if the operating system detects that some process is just creating patches and is making slow progress, then what the operating system can do is to yield that CPU, yield that process, yield the CPU, and then put that process P1 in the ready-to-run queue, and give another chance to other processes to run, and let them and see if they can progress faster. Okay? That's the basic idea of that solution. Now, we think that with these two solutions, non-blocking write will be able to perform as good as vanilla in the worst case. I think we can do that guarantee. We can have that guarantee. And we'll take the better advantage or we can do, we can improve the performance when it's able to take advantage of the misses. Okay.
So I'm not sure I understood why this lab situation is bad for...
Sure. So the thing is that, imagine that Sam is constantly writing to a patient in our memory. So every time there is a write, we need an operating system iteration. We need to create a patch and everything. So for every write, we actually need to do a lot of work. Even though we don't have to wait for the IO, we need to do a lot of work. In contrast, P2, in every write, it just needs to do the write because all the pages it needs is in memory, right? So this one, let's say that you're able to do, I don't know, 10 writes every unit of time, right? But with a lot of overhead. But in this case, since you have everything in memory, you're able to do much more than 10 operations per unit of time, right? So I guess the point is that P2 is able to, in this situation, is able to utilize the CPU much better. And make progress much faster.
But it affects throughput, but eventually both of these have to be done. So it's,
yes.
It doesn't really...
True. It does impact, because the thing is that this P1 is in the situation, is in this situation while the IO is completed, right? Once the IO is completed, P1 will start again in the same situation where it doesn't have to create patches, because the page is in memory. So while that happens, the CPU will be better utilized with some other process that is able to progress faster, right? So probably, I don't know, this is an example. Probably while P2 is in the CPU progressing faster, the IO finishes, and then P1, when it comes again, it can progress faster. Right? So you are not still utilizing the CPU.
There's some switching time, but some cost.
There is, but the point is that switching time will also happen in vanilla, so we are not actually adding additional time. Okay. Okay. So let's see how non-blocking write does in file system response time. This is experiment for the SpecSFS, which is a file server-like worker. Here we have the latencies of the different operations, but the point here is that with non-blocking writes in the file server, we're able to decrease the latency by 50%, from 5 milliseconds to 2.5 milliseconds approximately. Right? So the latency goes down 50% in this workload, and we also see that non-blocking writes is able to lower the variance from 10 to 2.
Can you also tell for people who cannot look at pointing which part you're looking at?
Oh, I'm talking about the SpecSFS write operation in the x-axis, right? The y-axis is response time. Right, so I was saying that the variance is much lower from 10 to 2. And the reason for that lower variance is because now the writes do not depend depend less on the performance of the backend store. We're making the fetch asynchronous, so the writes won't see that time. And then, well, the other thing is that the read latency remain unchanged, right? Which means that non-blocking write will not affect the performance of the reads. Actually, this is multi-threaded because the thing is that there are multiple clients to the server, right? We run this in the server, and I think there are 10 clients that are constantly executing requests. Right?
But how common is the server?
Excuse me?
How much do I
server?
How many server threads? I see.
Can you say what is different between non-blocking writes for file system and anonymous memory?
Yeah. Well, first about the number of threads. The number of threads, I guess, is depending on the implementation of the NFS server. This is running on NFS. So my guess is that it has multiple threads.
The NFS is multiple threads.
Okay. The other thing is that The problem I talked about here, this only happened in virtual memory. The thing is that in file system it really doesn't happen because all the overhead of creating, all the overhead of following a path in the kernel happens in all writes, right? In this case, if the page is in memory, you don't really need operating system intervention. But in the file system case, you always need the kernel intervention in order to do the write. Okay? So you can think that this situation won't happen because the progress of the write itself will be as fast independently of if you are creating a patch or not. So I guess we can move forward. To summarize non-blocking writes, we show it can allow asynchronous writes to pages that are not in memory. And we found in the evaluation we did that non-blocking write was able to reduce the execution time up to 7% to the memory size that we use. And for single-thread applications, and we are also able to reduce the write response time by 50% for file system like for file server like worker. In the multi-thread case, we see a degradation in performance, but we also propose some solutions that will allow non-blocking writes to do same as vanilla in the worst case. Now, the impact of having non-blocking writes. Well, first, it shows that it has the potential to increase the idleness of these in caching systems like SSE or Nexus. Now, it can also improve performance given that it decouples the performance of a vacuum store to write to pages that are not in memory. And also, I show that it can improve the viability of a new kind of energy efficient systems with reduced memory size to save idle power.
Yeah, I need to go back to that summary. Here you said 50% reduction for file system workloads, and you said that that's really multi-threaded systems. But then you say that there's a degradation.
True.
You said earlier that it was about 8%.
True.
Which means that
Sure.
are compensated already? Or
No. I guess in this multi-thread, I'm talking about virtual memory, the kind of you do faults, right, or memory accesses. In this case, I'm talking about file system cases, which is for the write system call, for instance. So it's actually a different kind. I guess I should have made that more clear. The degradation here is related to the virtual. It only happens to the case of virtual memory, the swap and the faults and so on. But that multi-threading problem doesn't happen in the file system case.
Also, you're looking at different numbers. For a multi-thread workload, you're measuring the overall performance of the application.
Mm-hmm.
And the 50% is the reduction on individual write response.
Yes.
For each individual write, of course, you have reduction.
Yes.
But then we are looking at the entire workload, which is amortized by all the time.
I see. Okay. I see. So you're saying that you're comparing the execution time itself with the latency of
performance.
When
one write is blocked, another write can be performed.
Yeah.
So you have to average of these two writes, you get the similar performance.
Yes.
Okay,
I see. Well, the thing is that in the file system case was a server, so we don't really have an execution time. There is no fixed task to do, so we can only report the time of your operations.
But how does, can you speculate whether there would be any client-side performance improvement when the write response times change on the server side?
Yeah, of course. My guess is that it will reduce the execution time, definitely, because
per request.
Per request. So in total, should I guess if it's doing a lot of writes to the server, then it should reduce the execution time.
I would suggest to run the multi-thread workload on that is
okay.
And then use
run
block and drive for the Linux server. I didn't see how much performance you get for the same workload. But now,
The problem is that I don't think that's going to work because the way the that workload is doing the IOS is not by issuing the write system call, but it's by faulting when the page is not in memory, right? So my guess is that it will have the same results, because the thing is that you still have the overhead of the fault itself, right? You have to go down to the kernel and up, and the kernel is the one that is doing the fetch and so on. So I don't think that's going to work. But I guess an application that is doing the write system calls, I guess it will have the same. It will decrease the execution time. Yeah.
Yeah. For this spec SFS, what is the metric of performance?
The metric of performance is two. Is the operations per second, and is the latency.
Okay.
Yeah.
And were you able to measure any of those?
Yeah. Well, the latency is the one that we saw here.
Okay.
And the operations per second, I have results as well. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
That would address the comment, the question, right?
The operations per second throughput. Of course. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. The operations per second was higher.
The same extent or as the reduction in the response time?
The thing is that the operations per second. The thing is that with the spec SFS, they have probably 10 different operations. So write is only one of those operations. So I don't think it will be the same expense because the writes are mixed within all the operations. Right?
But they are able to give you individual response time improvements for writes.
Yes.
But they don't have operations per second for writes?
I don't think so. I will have to check. But I remember that the operations per second in general was better. I don't remember how much.
And the other thing is that, I mean, can you answer the specific question that Ming asked about, okay, if you block on a write and then do a write and then follow up, you do another write, right? And if you have two writes, is it the same with when you have non-blocking writes and when you have blocking writes?
Whether
you're doing writes in parallel or you're doing them sequentially?
That was specific to file system or?
I mean, his question was specific to
policies,
but can you answer it?
Sure. So, if it's the same threat, let's say, and it's doing two writes to pages that are not in memory, it will definitely execute both at the same time, right? Because the operating system will create a pass, will respond them as done, and then will execute them in parallel.
With blocking writes,
what would happen is that the operating system, instead of creating a patch, it will fetch, it will issue the fetch, and it will keep the process waiting until that read is complete, right?
It will also issue less IOs to storage, right? That's a side effect of blocking page fetches. Less IOs in parallel to the storage.
Oh, less IOs in parallel. Okay. Yes.
So these are the things you talked about initially,
okay.
Which is good, but I mean the answer to
okay.
this question relates
okay.
to all
okay.
of those.
Yes. Yes. The outstanding IOs for the blocking case would be much lower because in a single thread is able to keep one IO at the same time in the vanilla, right? While a non-blocking thread is able to keep more than one. Okay, so I guess we can move on. Okay. Any other question? Okay. So in the conclusions, well, the first thing is that we show that it's important to solve the energy problem in disk and memory. And we show that using caching techniques can save power in disks. We show an area proportional system that is able to save from 36% to 59% of the power. And also, we see excess, which is able to save from 2% to 14% of the energy.
So in the same sentence, they're using power and energy. They're two
yes.
different concepts.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
You have to be careful.
Okay, okay. Okay. Yeah, I guess it's power. It's power. It's energy. No, because...
it's energy. Power is the rate of energy.
Yeah. Okay.
How do you measure it?
But
you need to make sure you understand the difference very clearly. I mean,
yeah.
A light bulb that's rated at 40 watts.
Yes.
The energy consumed is in watt hours.
Yes. Right. Right.
So this has to be energy savings, not.
Okay. Power. I see. But well, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. That's fine. Okay.
Consuming power, it may not even matter all that much. If you're consuming the same amount of energy.
Oh. Okay. I see. Okay. Okay.
The same amount of work done using fewer disks, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And this consumes constant amount of energy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
True. But at the end, we will have the same energy. Okay. I see. Okay. So actually, we're saving. We're reducing
energy.
Okay. What you have there is correct.
Okay.
You said power and energy.
Okay. 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 Sure. Okay. So, well, with non-blocking writes, we're able to eliminate the page fetch before a page. And we see that we can improve the execution time of single-thread applications. And also, we can reduce the write latency of five server workloads. Now, we also propose some solutions to the sub-optimal scaling problem we found with non-blocking write in multi-thread applications for VM case. And we show how non-blocking write has the potential to improve the effectiveness of excess and SRC map. Now, we also show how the performance improvement on non-blocking write can help in resource-constrained systems like new energy-efficient systems with a lower memory size and less power, idle power use.
Would it make sense to use excess and SRC map together?
Excuse me?
Which one is better? Axis and SRC map.
Which one?
You have two kind of solutions, right? Three
levels. Yes.
Which one is better?
Is better?
Yeah.
I think that how do you compare them? I guess the numbers are better for SRC map, right? And it makes sense if you want to achieve proportionality. I mean, I think proportionality makes a lot of sense. And the case of excess, I guess excess is mostly effective. It can be used for multi-disk systems as well, but we show it. You can, yes, you can. We were recently thinking of this kind of energy proportional, energy proportional system also using flash, where at the last level you have the flash, right? So you can power off all disks if you want and serve everything from flash, right? So you can use it together. Okay, finally, for future work, I think the challenge, the energy challenge next will be the memory. The thing is that SSDs are becoming much more and more popular, and that means that the storage energy share will be much smaller, and that will highlight the memory as a problem with energy. Now, the other problem is that the RAM size continues to increase, and this is a trend that will continue to happen. So it's important to save power in RAM, right? So there are two directions, and these two directions mainly try to address the RAM energy problem by reducing the size of the RAM. So we can reduce the power consumed by the idle power of the RAM. So the first one is we can explore the effectiveness of reducing memory with non-blocking write help, first, as I already mentioned. And another direction is that currently the smaller page generality is 4K, and there are hardware constraints where you can make it even smaller. So we can artificially reduce the page size and make that smaller, right? Make the memory size smaller. Okay, so, well, finally, I have here the publications I presented in this presentation, right? The first one is under review currently. And also I have the references just as a way to more or less measure the impact that each publication had. And these are other publications I have, which are not directly related to the dissertation. And finally, I want to thank my dissertation committee for the insightful comments, and also for reading my dissertation, and also collaborators in the lab for helping me in all the projects. And also, I didn't put it here, but I also want to thank Barbara because she helped me so much in the dissertation, and also she even gave me all the time insightful comments about the dissertation. So I want to thank her as well. So I think that's my last slide, and with that, I'm more than glad to take questions and our work.
Thank you, questions for Lewis?
Why
is that? What is the process of that? Take a feature
direction of reducing
page
size.
You
said artificially reducing page size.
Yes. Well, the thing is that by reducing.
That one, right? Yeah.
So okay. So, well, you can think if you're using just a small portion of a page, right? Then you can reduce, instead of using the whole page, you can just use the part that you're actually interested in, and then you don't need to keep all the complete page in memory. So at the end, the idea is that happens in a lot of pages, and you can reduce the memory size. Is that's your question, right? Yeah?
So, Louis, one thing that I saw is that you, in the beginning of the presentation, you said that saving energy can affect performance, right? You have to balance those two.
Yeah.
But also, most of the techniques that you use also have an impact on reliability.
Okay.
Right? So, did you look at the reliability implications of those systems, for instance, SRC map, because you're reducing from, let's say you have a 5 disk RAID and then you're using a...
Sure. Well, in particular in the case of SRC map, the way we address the reliability problem is that you can think of each individual disk as a, instead of a single disk, you can think of it as a multi-disk system, right? So each of them have redundancy.
Okay, so let's say a RAID 1.
Exactly. So the way we address reliability in SRC map is that we do replicas only in physical disks that have the same amount of reliability than the source disk, right? So if, for instance, this is a RAID 1, then you can only replicate your data in another RAID 1. That's the idea. So we add that restriction in order to keep the reliability.
Okay. But now you're talking about a distributed system.
Yeah.
Right? SRC map is a centralized system.
Well,
or you can have multiple RAIDs within a centralized
yeah,
system, and
yeah.
then
yeah. manage everything from
yeah.
Other questions? Any questions from the committee members? Committee members?
Hopefully, we are still there.
Can you go to Hangout and check, please?
Oh, my God.
Okay, that's 12:30.
You're running out of battery.
Okay. Sure enough. Okay. Do you have a recharger?
It's in the laptop.
Okay. So let me start and hang out. Again.
Start the Hangout and then.
Okay. So.
So when did we lose these guys?
Yeah. Have we been lost for too long or?
5 to 7 minutes.
Okay. So it's not half of the presentation. Which light do you miss? I mean. What point of the presentation do you stop seeing the presentation?
I think if you go back, can you go back a little bit? I think this was the last slide I saw.
Okay, so I guess it should repeat, right?
Yeah, repeat the feature or this slide and then the feature.
I think this slide is pretty much done. You can start from the next one.
Okay. Kaushik, can you hear us? Okay. So what I was saying in the future work is that the next energy challenge will be the memory. And the reason is that as SSDs are becoming more popular, the storage energy share will be much smaller. Okay? So, and the RAM will continue to increase, so that's a problem. Now, we cannot, the idea is to address these energy efficiency problem of the RAM by reducing the RAM size and reduce their idle power. So, one direction will be to explore the effectiveness of non-blocking write to reduce the memory, and also another direction is to artificially reduce the page size so we can keep in memory what is actually important, right? Even if it's just a subset of the page. So that's pretty much it. And then the publications related to the dissertation itself, and also also the references as a way to measure the impact of each publication. And finally, two additional publications not directly related to the dissertation. Right. And finally, the acknowledgments. And that's what you missed.
Sorry, first, I have a comment about the data. Make sure that the grammar is back. Oh, okay. I think we got this message. Okay.
think. Okay, so. So yeah, so at this point, I guess we were in the Q&A session. So if you any of you two have any questions, please go ahead.
We go back to the Hangout.
Okay.
And do you have power now?
Oh, I don't.
Okay.
Go ahead, Andre.
Okay, hi. I was just wondering, when about FICNet, when you explained it, you talked about rights, and you mentioned that the rights need to be replicated after the liability period is over. What do you do about liability of rights?
The reliability of rights?
Yeah.
I think Jorge asked similar questions. So the idea is that in SRC Map, I guess the idea is that we replicate the data only if we have the same reliability guarantees. So if you think of if you think of each disk instead of more like array, then if we are trying to replicate a data that is in a RAID 1, we will only replicate that data in a RAID 1 as well, right? Or better, I guess. That's the basic idea of the reality. So, we would have to lose the same amount of disks in order to actually lose the data.
Can you go back to that disk and actually, the slide and actually explain what you mean by that?
So if something
Sorry, I couldn't hear. What?
I don't have the slide. Something was originally replicated in the RAID 6, then we make overall 2 copies of that data?
Yeah. So, hold on. So the idea is that let's say that if we replicate the working set of C in A, the idea is that C and A should have the same level of redundancy, right? So we can keep reliably the data, right? Even if we have a new write.
I think the piece that you're missing is that C is not a single disk.
It's not a single disk, yeah.
It could be a RAID system.
Yes,
itself.
It could be a RAID system. Yeah.
Okay. But I mean, typically you have a RAID group, and then on the RAID group you can have multiple volumes that you can expose to the client. So in that case, it's probably possible that the multiple devices that are coming to the server, they are already sharing the same set of data.
They are all sharing the same, the same level.
I mean, in this case, you're assuming that the physical volumes are made with separate data.
Yes.
Is that the assumption?
Yeah.
Sure.
I guess in that case, the storage utilization manager, we have to protect the scratch space from outside access. So the idea, I guess what the storage utilization manager has to do is that it shouldn't export the scratch space in any way. So if that happens, then the information is secure, right?
That's sort of a hidden block.
So
I guess you can think of the scratch space as a hidden volume that is not open to direct access.
Yeah, and there is no way to access that.
But then if you have some hidden volume, let's like somebody who has sort of sized their particular volume for some performance, how would you make sure that the I/O from the scratch space cannot degrade the performance too much?
Sure. So what happened? Well, we have a consolidation interval of 2 hours. So every 2 hours we check what disks are going to remain on, right? Now, one of the things we have is that we can have a threshold that the administrator the administration should set, where if the performance is worse than the threshold that the administrator set, then we can reconsider the disks that need to be on. So we basically run again the active disks algorithm and reconsider that with the new load that it has, right? So it can, basically what I'm saying is that it can dynamically adapt to that situation.
Sure.
Okay. And how would you redo a redesign attack in Mac for a multi-tier array? So if, let's say, you have an array with 10 SSDs and 10 disks,
then would you do something different?
Well, I guess in that case, the good thing is that we know that the working set is the one that is mostly used. I guess we can try to make the scratch space in the SSD itself. So doing that not only allow for a better energy proportionality, but I guess it would also increase the performance, right? I guess if you put the scratch space in those SSDs, you can do an effective use of the SSDs with SLC map.
And to some extent, won't that only happen if somebody is using SSD tier for caching?
I see. Okay. Well,
do you have to redesign something?
I guess SLC map can be used with the caching system itself. In any case, SLC map is also a caching system. So my guess is that they can work together. So at the end, the caching system, what it will cache is more or less what SRC map is going to replicate, right? So I think it makes sense for both of them to work together and achieve what you're saying. Kaushik, do you have any question? It's very hard to hear. Can you come closer to the microphone? No idea. Can you type it then? Because actually we can't hear you.
You could also turn the volume to the projector.
Yes, max out. Oh, not side by side. Oh, okay. Okay, let me see if you typed. Trade off performance for energy efficiency. Increasing energy. I was confused by this thing because it's not so generic. Okay. Increasing energy. Right. efficiency may actually save energy? The application value. Please clarify. Oh, I see. Okay. Yeah. So what you're saying is that by making the application more efficient in executing, I guess you can also save power, right?
It's just the word energy, because I think power and energy.
Okay.
Mean,
okay. Energy. So efficiency may actually save energy. Okay. At the application layer. Okay. So, right. So what I was trying to say was that if you want to save energy further to what you have right now, you can also you can trade off some of the performance to save that energy. I guess that's what I was trying to say. Now, usually what you have to do then, because for instance, in the case of the CPU is a good example where you have lower performance and you are saving energy. But what you want to do is to try to close the performance gap of this energy efficient system and this non-energy efficient system. And I think that's a challenge, right? To be able to use the energy efficient state of the component, but at the same time not affect the performance. Okay? Right. Still like talking to a computer.
You should continue talking.
Okay. Sure. So one of the things I said is that prefetching, aggressive prefetching, can save power.
Read the question out.
Oh.
The guy.
Okay. Sure. The second question is that if prefetching, well, I guess it's more common that says that prefetching may not save energy, because there will be wasted resources for unutilized objects. Now, although that's true, if you have aggressive prefetching, you also have the potential to increase the heats that you will have in cache, right? So I guess that's the best you can do. If you don't do the aggressive prefetching, then you will access the disk anyway, right? But I think prefetching is a good attempt to do that energy saving, and it actually works. There's a system called laptop mode that it does help. okay. So
what about the extra memory that you need to prefetch the data? His comment may be related to that, is that to prefetch the data, you're wasting memory resources.
Sure. But, if you utilize, okay, you can actually create a mathematical model by which you can demonstrate it depends on the accuracy of the prefetching accuracy. Yes, you can do that. Okay.
It's very feeble. Kaushik, we can barely hear you. It's I'm not sure why. The volume here is max, so I don't think we can do much at this end.
We don't have a phone here.
Okay. So I think if I understand this correctly, what he's saying is that, okay, let's consider an adversarial scenario where your prefetching doesn't help at all.
Okay.
Right.
Right.
Then does it improve the energy efficiency?
Well, it won't, because now we will still spin up the disk to get the primary data, right? So it won't. And actually,
does it hurt?
Yeah, actually it can affect performance, because now you will use memory that that can be better utilized in some other way.
Right.
Yeah,
I think you need to view the comment more broadly.
Okay. Sure.
Yes.
It's getting better, but still it's very hard to hear.
One comment on the prefetching. Point that I'm trying to make is that the way you're presenting on the prefetching part of the caching is that prefetching is always prefetching the cache in the it's always a better scenario. You will never always get an anchor data, which is no other option. That's not it. I don't normally agree with that point, because if you prefet something and in the worst case scenario, so for example, you always prefet something that is your system will be totally energy inefficient. There should be some parameter on which it is dependent on. And I did not see that part.
I see. Sure. Okay. Okay. That applies to the aggressive caching the aggressive prefetching I was talking about. But in the case of access in particular, in the case of SRC map, we don't really do prefetching. We detect a working set based on history of access in the last few days. So in SRC map that won't be a problem. But in the case of access, we do prefetching, but the kind of prefetching we do is after that page was actually accessed. So in some sense, we first need to look at the history and we see if that page was accessed in the past. And in that case, then we will use that page, right? Which is in the case of reconfiguration, where we will bring that page into Flash, right? So I guess what I'm saying is that it's not a conventional prefetching in excess, but it's better than that.
I understand, but that will depend on some factors of your prediction accuracy.
Yes.
And I did not see that. How do we be so accurate that prefetching improves the performance?
So what exactly, Kaushik, if you don't mind, I'd like to rephrase your question and broaden it a little bit so that you can look at it in a wider context. First of all, forget about your work altogether, right?
Okay.
And let's think about prefetching in general for energy efficiency.
Okay.
Right? And laptop mode is based on that concept that it aggressively prefetches.
Yes.
Does it mean that laptop mode is not designed well if the prefetching accuracy is bad? Does that mean that the laptop mode will actually perform less energy efficiently than a system that does not have aggressive prefetching?
Well, if you, I guess that's a problem of prefetching, not only for energy problem, for energy, but also in general. If you prefetch something that you won't use in the future, at the end you're basically wasting memory and also wasting I/O because you use the disk for something that you didn't use at the end. So I guess in the case of if you're using prefetching to save energy, then if you have many misses of the data that you prefetch, you at the end not only will not save energy, but also you will hurt performance because you end up using resources inefficiently, right? Or something that at the end you don't utilize. So,
So the second part of Kaushik's question is, your work on Excess, you do, although you call it prefetching, it's not strict prefetching.
Yes.
What exactly are you doing there?
Well, in that case, we are doing something similar than SRC map. In the case of Excess, we are detecting what blocks we actually use in the past, and we're making that as our next working set that we're going to set in the flash itself, right? So I guess I call it prefetching is because we are fetching something or we're copying something in the flash before it's accessed, but whatever we're copying in the flash, we first detect that it was actually used. Right?
Okay. Using history to predict.
To predict what it's going to be used, yeah.
And what is that prediction accuracy of that approximately?
I don't remember those numbers, but I think it was actually quite good. I don't remember we had many misses.
Do you have the presentation?
I may have. Next week. Let's see. So, the area consumed. Right. So we have only the execution time and the energy consumed, but we don't have more than that. I don't have that information here. Display the computer comparison. Okay, so. Yeah. No, we don't have the data here. Sorry. Yeah. Okay.
Well, you have a related question, so maybe I can jump in here. So I think one of your slides, slide 13, I think it is. So you had this sort of cartoon.
13?
Yeah.
13, okay.
So here you showed how these three, the vanilla and the aggressive caching and the excess will perform relative to each other in terms of the idle time,
yes.
In terms of time between fetches.
Yes.
Do you have any evidence for this? Do you have data to support this?
Well, the evidence is in Excess itself. We see that we're able to save energy. We're able to keep the disks asleep longer with Excess than we do when aggressive caching on vanilla, right? So basically, I don't have the exact accesses, but I know the idle times, of course, will be longer.
I think it would really help to have a quick graph that shows how these three perform relative to each other.
I mean,
that's more of a cartoon that you're showing there.
Yeah, okay.
You have that in the other presentation.
So, yeah, that's why I was looking over there, but I didn't see it in our Excess presentation. Do you have it?
Sure. I have in that presentation, it's mostly the energy saving.
Yeah, but that's what.
That's the actual quantification.
That's no longer a cartoon anymore.
No. This is actual data. The idea here is, I don't know if I can make this bigger. Yeah, this is actual data. So here we have workloads, the idle, which is the system is not used at all, and the developer office and Postmark, which is the main live server. Is laptop mode is basically aggressive prefetching and aggressive buffering. Yes. Right. So a laptop mode is trying to do as much as it can in order to keep the disk idle just with the memory.
The difference with laptop mode and Nexus, what is the main, what are the main difference?
The main difference, well, first, the main difference is that Nexus has an additional device that it can use to cache and buffer more data than just the RAM itself. So it's able, of course, to reduce the activity that that the disk will see, right? And also we have a combination of Nexus and laptop mode. So which means that they both can be used together, right, to achieve more energy efficiency.
So you have four versions of Nexus, which is the one that I should be focusing on?
Right. So I guess that the most common would be Nexus with USB, which is USB is more available. Compact Flash used to be popular. I think it's not as popular now. So I guess the blue line compared to base, which is the red line, or even laptop mode, right? So if you see here, for instance, in developer for VLTK, this basically is a workload that edit the Linux kernel and compile several times. So if you see here, Nexus is able to save power compared to laptop mode, because, you know, given that it has more, it has a bigger space to hold more working set, then the disk can be left idle for longer period of time.
But in the other workloads, it doesn't do well.
Yeah, it's 2 out of 4 it seems to do
well. Yes. Yeah. Well, in the case of Postmark, think is that Postmark is mainly a write-intensive workload. So what is happening is that we're writing to the USB, which in turn is very slow. And at the end, the execution time ends up being much longer. And at the end, you end up consuming more power, right? Or more energy.
So it seems like the black guy does the best in almost all the cases, right?
In all the cases.
And
yeah.
Nexus plus laptop mode.
Yeah. Yes. I guess that is because compact flash is better in energy efficiency and also in performance. At the end we have better.
If you point us in that direction, than in the blue direction.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
So just a small clarification. I remember what happened here is that the USB driver had a problem that was a pooling-based driver. So essentially, you kept waking up the system even in idle time just by plugging in the USB device. So only that consumed some energy. So we had to compensate by that energy and additionally save more energy.
Yeah, so the thing is that I guess the CPU, because it was falling all the time, the CPU couldn't go to the most power.
Yeah, and there should be a graph on that, either there or from your distribution.
And here you had to also mention that the energy consumed is the total system energy.
The total system
energy. Storage energy.
Yes, yes. Here is also counted the CPU and the memory. Oh. Let me see.
Yeah, that's what I was saying.
Right. This is the one, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, this also shows compact flash to be slightly
better. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Now, but the compact flash also has better performance? I think we have that here. Actually the compact flash has comparable performance. So the performance is not better, but the energy efficiency is better. So, well, and here, which is more dry intensive, the compact flash is better. Right? So it doesn't affect performance as much.
It seems like you want to turn off excess in some cases, at least for these sorts of devices.
Yes. Yeah, well, one thing you can do is that if you see that that it's a write intensive and you are using a flash, you probably don't want to use excess, right? Disable that dynamically.
So how does this, I mean, how do you speculate this would map to more newer SSD technology? So if you want to use excess-like system on the server side with SSDs
right.
for energy saving, what would need to change?
I guess, well, the performance of the SSD would be, of course, much better than the USB. So my guess is that probably even the performance will be better by doing something like that. Not only the power saving, but also the performance will be better. So now in terms of what should be changed, one thing that we don't do in excess, it's like we are not really careful on how we do the writes in the flash, and that actually the way we do or how we do writes in flash can affect the performance of the flash. So probably one thing we would have to change is to be careful and write in a way so that the flash can maximize its performance.
And everything else stays the same.
I think it can stay the same. Yes. Yeah.
To change how writes go to the flash.
Yeah. The other thing is that in that case we have if it's in the server side we would have more disks. So we need more. We need a more complicated way to turn off the disks. Perhaps, well, I guess you have a better chance to save power because you can see what disks are more accessed or not accessed at all, and you can actually choose what disks you want to turn off. For instance, and that goes, by the way, on the side of SRC map as well. If you can cache, all the working set of a disk in the flash, then probably you want to turn off that disk, but the other ones leave it on because they will be used, right? So I guess there's some work there, additional work.
Can we go back to non-blocking, right?
Here, right? Okay.
So here you mentioned several possible improvements, and you said that you implemented all of these
yes.
things, like I guess if there's multiple writes, you
yes, that's our mainly optimization on the patch.
Two or three that you said you
with the patches itself. Yes. Yes.
Right, making reads.
We can read from the patch, we can merge patches to reduce the metadata.
Right,
size.
Now do you have gains from each one of these separately?
I do have gains, and actually have the data to calculate the effectiveness of them, but I guess I haven't done the blocks, but I do have the data. I know...
I mean, do you know if they're comparable, one is better than the other? Or just
no, they are complementary. They are complementary to each other. There is not really comparison between them.
And again, somewhere else you said something like 8% degradation in
multi-threaded.
In a multi-threaded
yes.
environment. So again, what is that average over a lot of different applications, or is it for write-intensive applications? Or
no, that's similar to these cases. In those cases were multi-thread applications of the capo, which is mostly developer kind of workloads and also server kind of workloads. There is a mix there, but probably they are also they could be write intensive because for instance in the case of in the case of a server, I think it was for instance an application server. There was one which was
do you have that block?
Database servers. I do have it in the dissertation.
Part of the problem here is that if there are not too many writes, then you're not going to save a whole lot.
Right.
Too many writes,
yes.
Again, you pay for
yes.
it a lot because of degradation. So I don't totally understand where the gains are. So some better understanding in terms
sure.
of the plot would really help.
Okay. So I actually have some graphs in the dissertation itself. Let me show them in the motivation section. So, this one, for instance, tells how much of the non-blocking writes, how much of the faults. This was only for virtual memory, right? And actually, I'm trying H2, for instance, which is this one. So, if we provision 50% of the memory. Of the working set, of the complete working set of the application, we're able to make non-blocking only 20% of the faults, right? That's
20%?
Point.
When you say only 20%, is that you're saying only because it's a small number or because it's smaller than the other one?
No, I guess it's, okay, it's 20%. It's not a small number. It's a significant number. Yeah. And I guess this has to be also, for instance, this table, which is a single thread applications.
All I'm saying is that you ought to see poorer performance on either end. If there are percentages of non-blocking writes are low or very high, and I'm not sure, can you show that? Is that you have data that supports this?
Then, sorry, I guess I didn't understand the question.
So if the number of writes are, if the number of non-blocking writes are very low, then you're not going to gain a whole lot.
Sure.
If it's very high, again, as you said, that there's a serious degradation in the performance. There's a lot more work that the operating system needs.
Okay, but well, That was the case only for single thread. For multi-thread. We only have degradations in multi-thread. In fact, if we have a lot of writes in single-thread applications, we still do better. We won't have degradation.
Single-thread is a very special case. I assume that we really want to study multi-threaded case, right?
Yes, sure.
So in the multi-threaded case, these two ends should the performance degradation should be much worse than some element.
No, actually, I think as you have more writes that you can handle a non-blocking write,
yeah.
You will always have gains in the performance. Even in multi-thread application, after we implement the improvements we talked about.
That's why I wanted to see if you had data that supports something that clearly shows, okay, all of these are really helping.
No, actually, I guess the best I have
yeah.
is that as you decrease the memory size in single threaded, right? That's what I have so far. In single threaded, as you decrease the memory size, you have more writes that you can handle asynchronously, and we see that there is actually improving the performance, right? So that's an indication that as you have more faults that you can have non-blocking writes.
I think these are all punchlines for your dissertation, and they really ought to be clearly supported by data or
okay.
by graphs of some kind.
Okay. Okay.
Let me go back to Giri's question or comment rather. In multi-threaded applications, is it true that if you have more writes or more non-blocking writes, your performance gets worse? I think that's something that he got from your presentation.
Okay, I see. No, actually.
So you're saying that's a misconception?
Yes. The problem, like I said, in the dissertation is more a scheduling problem. It's not because you are doing non-blocking writes, but it's because of you are using the CPU for a process that is progressing slower. So if we are able to detect which ones are going to progress faster, then we actually will have gains, right? Because we're able to make some of those writes asynchronous, So what we have is gains, and if we have more writes, we have more chance to make writes asynchronous, and then we will have more improvements, right?
So does the previous page show that as the number of percentage of non-blocking writes increases, that performance behaves in a certain way?
This one?
Yeah.
No, well, no, this doesn't. This just shows which fetches have the potential to be non-blocking writes, but it doesn't really show the improvements itself, right? What this shows, though, is that as the memory size, for instance, in H2, when the memory size is decreased, you have more fetches that can be asynchronous.
So since we're talking about non-blocking writes, and it seems like there is some confusion around what is the potential of non-blocking writes. I think it would make sense for you to talk a little bit about your experiments and how you configured memory and what would happen if that changes.
Because
I think it's important to understand the complete picture, because that although you have summary percentages,
mm-hmm.
it's important to point out that those percentages are a very limited view of the performance improvement or degradation. They are based on certain assumptions that you're making about how much resources are available in the system. Right? So can you talk a little bit more about that, and in reference to your memory sensitivity study?
So the default memory size we use. We set that memory size to exercise non-blocking writes, right? So we started with the working set size, and then we started reducing the memory size so that until the point we see some fetches happening. So we can, in that point, we can exercise non-blocking writes and see the improvement it has, right? The point is that once we have that, we can see how non-blocking writes will behave with better, with higher number of write faults as we decrease the memory, as we saw in the graph, and then show how non-blocking writes improvement increases. Right? Hopefully that's what you were talking about. Or?
Basically, you need to point out that the amount of memory you provide to these workloads can change these results.
Yeah, of course.
Right?
Yeah.
And you had 8% degradation.
Yes.
It could be better or it could be worse than that,
yes.
Depending on how much memory you provide to them.
Yes, sure.
Or there was 7% improvement.
Yes.
That could be better if you provision the system with less memory.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
So I think those are the kinds of things. And this graph in particular shows that, right? So you can use this graph to illustrate that point. So we have 25% memory provision versus 50% memory provision.
Yeah.
The amount of faults that you have the opportunity to improve on is different.
Yeah. Yes.
This system is going to perform differently as a function of the amount of memory
that
you provide to the system.
Yeah, and
now can the question is, can you create a system that will always either perform better or equivalent to existing systems?
That's a goal, and I think it can be done. What we're doing, first in the single threaded system, I think that's guaranteed. In the worst case, the application should perform just as good in vanilla on non-blocking writes. In the case of multi-threaded, with the improvements we show, I think we will be able to guarantee that as well, right? Because what we're basically doing is to give the system the chance to progress faster if it can, and if not, then we can progress at the pace of non-blocking write, but it's still progress, right? And what that means is that we are not going to increase the execution time of the application in that case.
So, maybe I have another misconception here, but the moment you reduce the memory size, aren't you also going to increase the number of faults? So even though the number of non-blocking faults you're able to that get benefited, it still doesn't matter because the number of faults is coming up quite a bit more. Which is higher than which? If you double the number of faults and if you don't double the percentage of, even if you double the percentage of faults you're able to deal with, you're still not going to, you're still not going to have a compatible performance.
Right. So, well, in that case, I guess what we try to do in that case is to see, it's true that it's not realistic, I guess, in the sense that you are not going to reduce your memory if you have more, right? I guess what we're trying to do in that experiment is to show that if you fix the execution time and you use non-blocking write, we actually need less memory in the case of non-blocking write to get the same execution time, right? So that was what we were trying to do with that graph. What that means is that you can either reduce the memory and have the same execution time, or with the same amount of memory, you can improve your performance. Right? So.
Okay. Any other questions for Lewis? Okay, so then we should have the closed session.
Okay. So just to make sure, Kaushik and Aye, are you still there?
Yeah, let's make sure.
Yeah. Yeah?
How about Kaushik?
Kaushik?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, great. So
I guess I have to.
Yeah. We'll call you back after we're done.
Sure. Thanks.
Okay, so what do you think about Lewis's defense? Let's get your comments and then, I'll also share what I thought.
Well, I'll let the people who are closer to the field say something more.
Okay. maybe we can hear from Ming then first.
Certainly he has done a lot of work. He's good enough for his degree. But I think particularly the last piece of his work, I think there's still a lot of room to improve. In terms of presentation, I think he could have been more precise. and the user uses the average dispatcher. I don't need that average dispatcher.
I agree. Giri, your thoughts?
Yeah, no, I think that that's very accurate. In many places I've said the same thing. I think there were comments also saying, yeah, you're making this general statement, where is the evidence for this? A simple data graph would have supported this. Maybe he has the data, maybe he doesn't. And in the last part for sure, I think that there are clear conclusions that he's making, and those need to be clearly supported by graphs or by data of some kind.
Ajay, your thoughts?